we're on to kind of arty things, bit artier than the phone book. The concept of a muse, maybe rooted in Greek mythology, but the idea that a singular person is the inspiration for some of our wonderful artists, poets and musicians continues to this day. Among those who are credited as muses include Marianne Elen, inspiration for some of Leonard Cohen's best-known songs, and now the subject of a new film, Maud Gonne, for some of William Butler Yeats' poetry. To look at the lives of muses, I'm joined by the poet Rachel Hegarty, Dr. Aoife Brady from the National Gallery of Ireland, and Jim Lockhart from Horselips. I'm going to start with you, if I may, Aoife, because having read all this stuff about muses, and I would always have been very envious, you know, of people, oh, muse, I wouldn't fancy being a muse at all.
I'm not sure that I would either, Marion.
Yeah.
Not as a woman, anyway.
Right. Give us the background to the whole thing, you know, and where the concept comes from, Greek mythology, etc., etc.
Sure. Well, it originates, as you say, in Greek mythology. There were nine muses. They were minor goddesses who inspired poetry and music and the arts. Interestingly enough, the visual arts was not represented by one of the nine ancient muses, but now it's often associated with visual arts and painters, more specifically.
Right, yeah. And were they always women? Rachel, let me ask you.
Muses? No, not always. We have quite a heteronormative idea of
heteronormative
muses. Yeah, it's always going to be some beautiful woman coming up and whispering something that you half hear in your ear, in a man's ear, I might add. But actually, if we look at the likes of our own Oscar Wilde, Boise distracted him. And if you look at the Ballad of Reading Gale, that is a story of a young gay man inspiring another gay man to write a beautiful poem. And so that's the muse, the Greek traditional Eurocentric muse thrown on its head.
Right.
So,
okay, let me come back. No, I'll come to you because you did see that documentary, didn't you?
Yeah, I saw it the other night, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful film.
Really?
It's gorgeous, yeah, yeah. And it's really, it's kind of surprising. You're right about, like, muses didn't get a great time. She didn't, Marianne Elen didn't have a great time. He lived with her on Hydra in Greece for a couple of years.
This is Leonard Cohen.
Cohen did. When he was writing his novel Beautiful Losers, which went down like a lead balloon. Everybody hated it. And at that stage, he reckoned he wasn't going to make it as a writer. And he was living off her at that stage. She was paying the rent. And that's when he started writing songs, and she encouraged him in that. And one word buried another, and then he went off to America, and Judy Collins persuaded him that he could sing. And then he kind of took off, and at that stage, Marianne Elen used to sort of go out on the road with him occasionally, but gradually she was losing hold of him. And that led to a number. He said himself in the intro to one of his concerts, I wrote this song about a woman I used to live with. And then he said, I used to live with her for 10 months of the year. And then I used to live with her for 6 months of the year. And then I used to live with her for 2 months of the year. And then it works out. And now he says, I live with her for a couple of days a year. But in fact, it was a long period of intense pain for her. And eventually, the mother of his child, when he hooked up with this other woman in Canada, came over to Hydra and marched in and says, OK, when are you leaving? Into the house in Hydra. So Marianne Elen didn't put up a fight. She just said, OK. And she took her son from her earliest marriage and the pair of them headed off back to Norway. And she settled down to a suburban life with, she married a dentist or a doctor or something like that.
Right.
So it led to a long period of pain for her. I mean, not a happy experience. A beautiful film. It's a really nice film. I was amazed by the amount of acid that Cohen took. He was tripping morning, noon and night. I never would have believed that it was possible to come out of it sane, yeah.
I'll start the other way around, so to speak. Obviously, Marianne, what else would she have inspired?
Bird on a wire. She looked out of the house on Hydra one day and saw a bird sitting on a telegraph wire and said, that looks like a musical note here. Come and have a look. You should write a song about that. So he wrote Bird on a Wire.
Right.
And then obviously, like, So Long Marianne was her. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's have a listen to that.
We met when we were almost young. Deep in the green lilac park.
It's still just stunning, isn't it? Who did you say made the movie?
Nick Broomfield, who a regular documentary maker, and he always has this like self-deprecating tone, and you see him in his films standing around holding the mic himself, holding this big sort of fur-covered microphone. Yeah. And he's always a bit kind of bumbling and Bertie Wooster-ish. And in fact, it turns out that he made the film because he lived on Hydra for a bit and lived for a while with Marianne until some previous lover of hers turned up and she threw him out.
They led a colourful life.
The 60s, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, there's more to come as well. I know. Now, let me go back to... I was thinking about the girl with the pearl earring. But if you go through... Female artists were artists in their own right and their work was frequently overlooked. And it ended in tragedy for a lot of them.
It certainly did. We do have...
Give us a few stories.
Well, we have many, many stories. Auguste Rodin, the famous sculptor, his partner Camille Claudel was a really decent artist and a recognised artist in her own right. And she and Rodin were lovers. And apparently when Rodin refused to leave his long-term partner for Camille... she destroyed all of her work and she had a nervous breakdown. And there are many, many stories like this. Similarly, Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, they were both artists. And yet, during their lifetime, Rivera was infinitely more famous and overshadowed his wife considerably. And it's only today that she's being recognised for her work.
Yeah. And Picasso...
Picasso, my God, for saying Leonard Cohen was a bad man.
I wanted to shoot Picasso as well.
Picasso, I mean, there are about six people that we might identify as Picasso's muses throughout his career, and very few of them had good ends. He had four children with three different women. Two of his muses, very tragically, took their own lives. And one of the most famous, Dora Maar, their relationship ended similarly in tragedy with her... nervous breakdown, and she spent the final decades of her life in an asylum. After her love affair ended with Picasso, she said that she turned to religion, and she said, "After Picasso, only God." So that was the end of.
It's just extraordinary. And why was it? Why was it so difficult? Because quite a few of them, astonishing amount of them, ended up in asylums or with nervous breakdowns. Is it that it's a different relationship or a more intense relationship?
It certainly seems to have been intense, and these women were put on pedestals. A lot seems to have been expected from them creatively, and the artists themselves demanded a lot of the women. And they seemed disposable to a lot of these artists. When they were finished with them, when they've gotten the inspiration that they required, they're discarded in a lot of instances.
Yeah, it just doesn't have to be women, though. I mean, people, historical events... before I leave that, she was the inspiration for Guernica, wasn't she?
She was, amongst others. Guernica and the Weeping Woman in the Tate. So these are two of Picasso's most famous paintings.
Yeah.
Dora Maar actually put a few strokes of paint on Guernica, and that would have been really unusual for Picasso to allow a woman to have been part of his working process.
Yeah, and to photograph it. Bring me to poetry and how it has worked in there, and that other things besides human beings can be so inspirational.
Absolutely. In the Irish poetry tradition, the Din Seanachas, the sense of place has a great inspiring. So we hear it in Heaney's Glenmore sonnets or his Moss Bond poems. We hear it in Evan Boland's Dublin poems, Paul Amin's Northside Dublin poems, even our own Stephen James Smith. They look at Dublin as their muse.
Yeah.
Rita Ann Higgins does it for Galway. You have the likes of Sinead Morrissey doing it for Belfast, using this sense of place as an inspiration. So there is that Din Seanachas that can inspire you. But in terms of, I also think, even in the poets that I've mentioned there, it's turns around of this trope of the bad end for the muse when women take control and start to make their own art. And that's where things turn around. And if we remember and go back to those nine sisters, the nine sisters were reared by Apollo, and they were concerned with making art, not everyday tasks. Hence, I'm really bad housekeeper. I just look at making me poems and not doing me
polishing. What an excuse.
It's
what?
A great excuse. So
the nerve of you, but anyway, does it work?
It does work. Yeah. Your husband's a great cook. Yeah. So you can turn it around. Or even historical events, you know, Easter 1916, one of our most famous poems. I used my own second collection, May Day 1974, about the Dublin and Monaghan bombings. And for me, the inspiration there came from the voices of the families of the victims and them using their spoken word as an inspiration. So you can have a sense of place, the spoken word of your people, your family, your friends, or historical events all around you. So there's these different sense of how a muse does not always come in the female form. And then also a muse can be quite a Eurocentric idea. Like you have the wonderful poet Phyllis Wheatley, who is from Senegal and survived the mid-passage trip across the Atlantic and got to Boston and wrote poems in English in 1753, wrote poems in English with African literary tropes that we can even hear today in somebody like Chiamaka Anya, who are Dublin Nigerian poet, and you hear those same African tropes of, you know, colour and skin colour and the sun and the water as part of that. So we do have a particular Eurocentric idea of muse, and you have to be a beautiful young woman to inspire. And also in the sense of my own poems, my husband, he's gorgeous and he totally inspires me.
There you go. That's another way of getting out and doing the housekeeping. Do you don't fool me? Queen
it takes
Archie.
One to know one.
Queen Artie Lyra.
Yes. So the Lament for Art O'Leary, like that was wonderful.
Beautiful.
Absolutely beautiful poem in Irish that's translated by like many Irish and English poets, like Dermot Bulger, that has a lovely translation of looking at the whole idea of a woman who is inspired by the death of her husband. So what happens is Eileen Dove Ni Conall is married young, her old husband dies, she meets this handsome hussar, an Irishman who had been with the Hungarian hussars. He comes over, hangs out in Kerry around the neighbourhood on his beautiful big white horse. The English won't let him have a horse that's over the value of the penal laws. And he gets shot dead for his impertinence of not selling his beautiful horse to an English soldier. And Eileen Dove Ni Conall writes this beautiful lament that is just gorgeous. And that's where I do think love is the inspiration that comes up and whispers in your ear and says,
well, I
do
think
something.
A lot of people would love anybody who can sing that properly to come to any gathering that they had that was going. Now, there's also Maud Gonne.
Yes.
Well, everybody kind of knows about Maud Gonne.
They do, but you know what's amazing to me, like I work in the Trinity Access Programme and my students are like, oh yeah, Maud Gonne, she drove V8 staffed. And I'm like, yeah, she certainly did. And a lot of our students would know the song of Wandering Angus from Christy Moore's wonderful rendition of that song. And the thing that a lot of people don't know is that Maud Gonne and Yeats consummated their relationship in Paris. And afterwards...
I did not know
just
that.
The once, I believe.
1908. And after that...
How do you know?
It's in a letter. After that, he wrote to his friend, and he wrote that the tragedy of intercourse is the perpetual virginity of the soul. And I have no idea what he's on about. But when I read that, I was like, me ma is bang on. You treat them mean, you keep them keen.
Jim Lockhart, I've never seen you drop your mouth open before.
I never knew that about Maud Gonne and Yeats.
Neither did I.
That's astonishing.
Neither did
Brilliant.
I.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, my image of Maud Gonne and Yeats is Annie West's cartoons.
It seems to have killed the romance for them, though, sadly.
I think that's really interesting.
Oh, no, so do I. Like, I was there going, oh, my God, my mother was bang on. Yeah, it did kill the romance. But, I mean, it's interesting because when you look at photographs of Maud Gonne and, indeed, Isolde Gonne, who Yeats also proposed to, they were stunners, like absolute smashers. And even Isol Gunn turned the head of Ezra Pound, the great American poet, as well. So they did have that ethereal beauty. But, you know, Yeats could have done better than not chasing around his mystical woods like Wandering Angus he became himself.
Now, this is all very interesting, learning all sorts of things going on here. Now, we've all heard about the Beatles, for God's sake.
Yeah,
but I've learned much more from you. Tell us about the muses within the Beatles.
Well, Paddy Boyd would be the kind of most conventional, I suppose, example. She was married to George Harrison. She was a model and an actress, and she got a job in... what was the black and white film? Hard Day's Night.
Yeah.
And she's a schoolgirl, a little schoolgirl's uniform on the train. And George chatted her up on that, and one thing led to another, and they got married. And after some years, he got friendly. As the Beatles were breaking up towards the end of 1969 and 70, he got friendly with Clapton, Eric Clapton. And Clapton developed this utter infatuation with Paddy Boyd and spent years chasing her. She turned him down in 1970. She eventually relented in 1974. They had a bit of a kind of a fling on and off, but she kind of kept him at it, kept him mean, keep him keen. Kind of eventually she split up with George and married Clapton, and that didn't turn out well either. That was a very unhappy marriage.
Right.
And but she inspired a couple of wonderful songs. Layla was like complete heartfelt pain from Clapton to her. Beautiful love song.
Right.
Because he identified with this Persian poet who wasn't able to get this beautiful woman, Layla.
Right.
So Clapton went mad for her, you know. And she inspired something in the way she moves and Wonderful Tonight.
And tell me about Yoko Ono. I mean, she gets universally blamed for destroying the Beatles.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily go along with that.
I wouldn't be a big fan of Yoko's. I mean, there are two kinds of people. There are people who like Yoko and people who don't like Yoko. And I'm kind of a person who doesn't like Yoko much. I think she kind of set her cap very specifically at Lennon and went at it kind of bald-headed. And even when the Beatles were in India being nice and spiritual with the Maharishi and stuff like that, Lennon insisted on having separate bedrooms from Cynthia, his wife at the time, not because he claimed he needed to be able to meditate and he couldn't meditate in a shared bedroom. In fact, what he was doing was sneaking off down to the post office to send telegrams to Yoko, who was at him constantly. She had tried to get hold of McCartney first. That didn't work out, so she went after Lennon. It looks like, I mean, there's interpretations of that, obviously. But then she really did become a muse. I mean, she became like a mother figure come muse, and she inspired stuff like Imagine. Yeah. And
how did his wife find out how things...
I think you couldn't be a Beatle wife and not know that the lads were carrying on, particularly George. George was a divil altogether, apparently.
Right, But did Yoko walk in on her one day?
She came in 1968, I think.
The wife walked in.
The wife walked in. They had got back to when they came back from India. The wife went off, Cynthia went off to a holiday in Greece, and Lennon called up Yoko, and she came around and they spent the night working on an album, which became Two Virgins. They made Love at Dawn then.
Right.
And a couple of days later, Cynthia comes back and walks in to find Yoko in her bathrobe sitting drinking tea with Lennon. And Lennon looks up and says, "Oh, hi." Rough enough, you know.
Very
All's
rough.
Fair in love and war, my
no,
eye.
No, it isn't.
It really isn't.
Absolutely. Now, you've picked Imagine, but what I found really interesting was the story of Get Back.
Oh yeah. Well, the other Beatles, she was causing ructions in the Beatles because Lennon brought her in on recording sessions, which was a no-no. You didn't do that. No chicks on gigs, so they were very unhappy about this. Plus, which she was a bit bonkers and she was screeching, doing like avant-garde screeches and stuff, which never went down well. And so Get Back was like McCartney's coded message to Yoko, because Jojo was originally Yoko, get back to where you once belonged.
Sounds like Donald
pre-Trump.
Trump.
Pre-Trump, yes. Absolutely. Prefiguring Trump.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'd love to get a little bit of Imagine in before we go, but just very briefly, tell me about the exhibition currently on the National Art Gallery.
A pleasure, yes. We've just opened today, Sorolla, Spanish Master of Light. Sorolla was a Spanish painter alive at the beginning of the 1900s.
Yeah.
And he had an overwhelmingly positive muse, his wife Clotilde, so they weren't all bad.
Okay.
And do come and see big, big pictures of sun and seaside. Really worth it for rainy August afternoons.
Okay. And Yoko did inspire this, didn't she?
Oh, she did, yeah.
We won't hear all that you picked, but just a tiny bit. Just saying, Joni Mitchell is another one.
Yeah.
And there's Bob Dylan and Edie Sedgwick.
That's right.
Andy Warhol.
Another sad, really tragic story.
The things all of you know about other people's private lives, but the rest of us are very interested too. Anyway, listen, may I say thank you very, very much indeed, excuse me, to Dr. Aoife Brady, Jim Lockhart, and Rachel Hegarty.